now. He had to keep his head turned while she dressed.
How you like the people, Bigger?
They all right.
You don't act like you glad.
Oh, Ma, for Christ's sakes, you want me to cry?
Bigger, sometimes I wonder what makes you act like you do.
He had spoken in the wrong tone of voice. He had to be careful. He fought down the anger rising in him. He was in trouble enough without getting into a fuss with his mother.
You got a good job now,
his mother said.
You ought to work hard and keep it and try to make a man out of yourself. Someday you'll want to get married and have a home of your own. You got your chance now. You always said you never had a chance. Now you got one.
He heard her move about, and he knew that she was dressed enough for him to turn round. He strapped the suitcase and set it by the door. Then he stood at the window, looking wistfully out at the feathery flakes of falling snow.
Bigger, what's wrong with you?
He whirled. Nothing, he said, wondering what change she saw in him. Nothing. You just worry me, that's all, he concluded, feeling that, even if he did say something wrong, he had to fight her off him now. He wondered just how his words really did sound. Was the tone of his voice this morning different from other mornings? Was there something unusual in his voice since he had killed Mary? Could people tell he had done something wrong by the way he acted? He saw his mother shake her head and go behind the curtain to prepare breakfast. He heard a yawn. He looked and saw that Vera was leaning on her elbow, smiling at him.
You get the job?
Yeah.
How much you making?
Oh, Vera, ask Ma. I done told her everything.
Goody, Bigger got a job, sang Vera.
Oh, shut up, he said.
Leave him alone, Vera, the mother said. What's the matter? What's the matter with him all the time? Asked the mother.
Oh, Bigger, said Vera, tenderly and plaintively.
That boy just ain't got no sense, that's all, the mother said. He won't even speak a decent word to you.
Turn your head so I can dress, Vera said.
Bigger looked out the window. He heard someone say, aw, and he knew that Buddy was awake.
Turn your head, Buddy, Vera said.
Okay.
Bigger heard his sister rushing into her clothes.
You can look now,
Vera said. He saw Buddy sitting up in bed, rubbing his eyes. Vera was sitting on the edge of a chair, with her right foot hoisted upon another chair, buckling her shoes. Bigger stared vacantly in her direction. He wished that he could rise up through the ceiling and float away from this room forever.
I wish you wouldn't look at me, Vera said.
Huh? Said Bigger, looking in surprise at her pouting lips. Then he noticed what she meant and poked out his lips at her. Quickly, she jumped up and threw one of her shoes at him. It sailed past his head and landed against the window, rattling the panes.
I told you not to look at me,
Vera screamed. Bigger stood up, his eyes red with anger. I just wish you had hit me, he said.
You, Vera?
The mother called.
Ma, make him stop looking at me,
Vera wailed. Wasn't nobody looking at her, Bigger said.
You looked under my dress when I was buttoning my shoes.
I just wish you had hit me, Bigger said again.
I ain't no dog,
Vera said.
Come on in the kitchen and dress, Vera, the mother said.
He makes me feel like a dog.
Vera sobbed with her face buried in her hands, going behind the curtain.
Boy, said Buddy, I tried to keep awake till you got in last night, but I couldn't. I had to go to bed at 3. I was so sleepy I could hardly keep my eyes open.
I was here before then, Bigger said.
Oh, no, I was up.
I know when I got in. They looked at each other in silence.
Okay, Buddy said.
Bigger was uneasy. He felt that he was not handling himself right.
You get the job? Buddy asked.
Yeah.
Driving?
Yeah.
What kind of a car is it?
A Buick.
Can I ride with you sometime?
Sure, soon as I get settled. Buddy's questions made him feel a little more at ease. He always liked the adoration Buddy showed him.
Gee, that's the kind of job I want,
Buddy said. It's easy.
Will you see if you can find me one?
Sure. Give me time.
Got a cigarette?
Yeah. They were silent, smoking. Bigger was thinking of the furnace. Had Mary burned? He looked at his watch. It was 7 o'clock. Ought he go over right now without waiting for breakfast? Maybe he had left something lying round that would let them know Mary was dead. But if they slept late on Sunday mornings, as Mr. Dalton had said, they would have no reason to be looking round down there.
Bessie was by last night,
Buddy said. Yeah?
She said she saw you in Ernie's kitchen shack with some white folks?
Yeah, I was driving them last night.
She was talking about you and her getting married.
Hmm.
How come gals that way, Bigger? Soon as a guy get a job, they want to marry.
Damn if I know.
You got a good job now. You can get a better gal than Bessie,
Buddy said. Although he agreed with Buddy, he said nothing.
I'm going to tell Bessie,
Vera called. If you do, I'll break your neck, Bigger said.
Hush that kind of talk in here,
the mother said.
Oh, yeah,
Buddy said.
I met Jack last night. He said you almost murdered old Gus.
I ain't having nothing to do with that gang no more, Bigger said emphatically.
But Jack's all right,
Buddy said. Well, Jack, but none of the rest. Gus and G.H. and Jack seemed far away to Bigger now, in another life, and all because he had been in Dalton's home for a few hours and had killed a white girl. He looked round the room, seeing it for the first time. There was no rug on the floor, and the plastering on the walls and ceiling hung loose in many places. There were 2 worn iron beds, 4 chairs, an old dresser, and a drop-leaf table on which they ate. This was much different from Dalton's home. Here, all slept in one room. There, he would have a room for himself alone. He smelt food cooking, and remembered that one could not smell food cooking in Dalton's home. Pots could not be heard rattling all over the house. Each person lived in one room, and had a little world of his own. He hated this room, and all the people in it, including himself. Why did he and his folks have to live like this? What had they ever done? Perhaps they had not done anything. Maybe they had to live this way precisely because none of them, in all their lives, had ever done anything, right or wrong, that mattered much.
Fix the table, Vera. Breakfast ready,
the mother called.
Yes'm.
Bigger sat at the table and waited for food. Maybe this would be the last time he would eat here. He felt it keenly, and it helped him to have patience. Maybe someday he would be eating in jail. Here he was, sitting with them, and they did not know that he had murdered a white girl and cut her head off and burned her body. The thought of what he had done, the awful horror of it, the daring associated with such actions, formed for him for the first time in his fear-ridden life a barrier of protection between him and a world he feared. He had murdered and had created a new life for himself. It was something that was all his own, and it was the first time in his life he had had anything that others could not take from him. Yes, he could sit here calmly and eat and not be concerned about what his family thought or did. He had a natural wall from behind which he could look at them. His crime was an anchor, weighing him safely in time. It added to him a certain confidence, which his gun and knife did not. He was outside of his family now, over and beyond them. They were incapable of even thinking that he had done such a deed, and he had done something which even he had not thought possible. Though he had killed by accident, not once did he feel the need to tell himself that it had been an accident. He was black, and he had been alone in a room where a white girl had been killed. Therefore, he had killed her. That was what everybody would say anyhow, no matter what he said. And in a certain sense, he knew that the girl's death had not been accidental. He had killed many times before, only on those other times there had been no handy victim or circumstance to make visible or dramatic his will to kill. His crime seemed natural. He felt that all of his life had been leading to something like this. It was no longer a matter of dumb wonder as to what would happen to him and his black skin. He knew now. The hidden meaning of his life, a meaning which others did not see and which he had always tried to hide, had spilled out. No, it was no accident, and he would never say that it was. There was in him a kind of terrified pride in feeling and thinking that some day he would be able to say publicly that he had done it. It was as though he had an obscure but deep debt to fulfill to himself in accepting the deed. Now that the ice was broken, could he not do other things? What was there to stop him? While sitting there at the table waiting for his breakfast, he felt that he was arriving at something which had long eluded him. Things were becoming clear. He would know now how to act from now on. The thing to do was to act just like others acted, live like they lived, and while they were not looking, do what you wanted. They would never know. He felt in the quiet presence of his mother, brother, and sister a force, inarticulate and unconscious, making for living without thinking, making for peace and habit, making for a hope that blinded. He felt that they wanted and yearned to see life in a certain way. They needed a certain picture of the world. There was one way of living they preferred above all others, and they were blind to what did not fit. They did not want to see what others were doing, if that doing did not feed their own desires. All one had to do was be bold, do something nobody thought of. The whole thing came to him in the form of a powerful and simple feeling. There was, in everyone, a great hunger to believe that made him blind. And if he could see while others were blind, then he could get what he wanted and never be caught at it. Now who on earth would think that he, a black, timid, Negro boy, would murder and burn a rich white girl and would sit and wait for his breakfast like this? Elation filled him. He sat at the table, watching the snow fall past the window, and many things became plain. No, he did not have to hide behind a wall or a curtain now. He had a safer way of being safe, an easier way. What he had done last night had proved that. Jan was blind. Mary had been blind. Mr. Dalton was blind. And Mrs. Dalton was blind. Yes, blind in more ways than one. Bigger smiled slightly. Mrs. Dalton had not known that Mary was dead while she had stood over the bed in that room last night. She had thought that Mary was drunk because she was used to Mary's coming home drunk. And Mrs. Dalton had not known that he was in the room with her. It would have been the last thing she would have thought of. He was black, and would not have figured in her thoughts on such an occasion. Bigger felt that a lot of people were like Mrs. Dalton. blind.
Here you are, Bigger,
his mother said, setting a plate of grits on the table. He began to eat, feeling much better after thinking out what had happened to him last night. He felt he could control himself now. Ain't you all eaten? He asked, looking round.
You go on and eat. You got to go. We'll eat later, his mother said.
He did not need any money, for he had the money he had gotten from Mary's purse, but he wanted to cover his tracks carefully. You got any money, Ma?
Just a little, Bigger.
I need some.
Here's a half. That leaves me exactly $1 to last till Wednesday.
He put the half dollar in his pocket. Buddy had finished dressing and was sitting on the edge of the bed. Suddenly, he saw Buddy. Saw him in the light of Jan. Buddy was soft and vague. His eyes were defenseless, and their glance went only to the surface of things. It was strange that he had not noticed that before. Buddy, too, was blind. Buddy was sitting there, longing for a job like his. Buddy, too, went round and round in a groove and did not see things. Buddy's clothes hung loosely compared with the way Jan's hung. Buddy seemed aimless, lost, with no sharp or hard edges, like a chubby puppy. Looking at Buddy, and thinking of Jan and Mr. Dalton, he saw in Buddy a certain stillness, an isolation, meaninglessness.
How come you looking at me that way, Bigger?
Huh?
You looking at me so funny.
I didn't know what I was thinking.
What?
Nothing. His mother came into the room with more plates of food, and he saw how soft and shapeless she was. Her eyes were tired and sunken, and darkly ringed from a long lack of rest. She moved about slowly, touching objects with her fingers as she passed them, using them for support. Her feet dragged over the wooden floor, and her face held an expression of tense effort. Whenever she wanted to look at anything, even though it was near her, she turned her entire head and body to see it, and did not shift her eyes. There was in her heart, it seemed, a heavy and delicately balanced burden, whose weight she did not want to assume by disturbing it one whit. She saw him looking at her.
Eat your breakfast, Bigger.
I'm eating. Vera brought her plate and sat opposite him. Bigger felt that even though her face was smaller and smoother than his mother's, the beginning of the same tiredness was already there. How different Vera was from Mary. He could see it in the very way Vera moved her hand when she carried the fork to her mouth. She seemed to be shrinking from life in every gesture she made. The very manner in which she sat showed a fear so deep as to be an organic part of her. She carried the food to her mouth in tiny bits, as if dreading its choking her, or fearing that it would give out too quickly.
Bigger!
Vera wailed.
Huh? You stop now,
Vera said, laying aside her fork and slapping her hand through the air at him.
What? Stop looking at me, Bigger.
Aw, shut up and eat your breakfast.
Ma, make him stop looking at me.
I ain't looking at him, Ma.
You is,
Vera said.
Eat your breakfast, Vera, and hush,
said the mother.
He just keeps watching me, Ma.
Gal, you crazy, said Bigger.
I ain't no crazier than you.
Now both of you hush, said the mother.
I ain't gonna eat with him watching me,
Vera said, getting up and sitting on the edge of the bed. Go on and eat your grub, Bigger said, leaping to his feet and grabbing his cap. I'm getting out of here.
What's wrong with you, Vera?
Buddy asked.
Tend to your business,
Vera said, tears welling to her eyes.
Will you children please hush?
The mother wailed.
Ma, you oughtn't let him treat me that way,
Vera said. Bigger picked up his suitcase. Vera came back to the table, drying her eyes.
When will I see you again, Bigger?
The mother asked. I don't know, he said, slamming the door. He was halfway down the steps when he heard his name called.
Say, Bigger!
He stopped and looked back. Buddy was running down the steps. He waited, wondering what was wrong. What you want? Buddy stood before him, diffident, smiling.
I...
What's the matter?
Shucks, I just thought...
Bigger stiffened with fright.
Say what you so excited about.
I reckon it ain't nothing. I just thought maybe you was in trouble.
Bigger mounted the steps and stood close to Buddy. Trouble? What you mean? He asked in a frightened whisper.
I just thought you was kind of nervous. I wanted to help you, that's all. I just thought...
How come you think that? Buddy held out a roll of bills in his hand.
You dropped it on the floor, he said.
Bigger stepped back, thunderstruck. He felt in his pocket for the money. It was not there. He took the money from Buddy and stuffed it hurriedly in his pocket. Did Ma see it?
No.
He gazed at Buddy in a long silence. He knew that Buddy was yearning to be with him, aching to share his confidence, but that could not happen now. He caught Buddy's arm in a tight grip.
Listen, don't tell nobody, see? Here, he said, taking out the roll and peeling off a bill. Here, take this and buy something, but don't tell nobody.
Gee, thanks, I won't tell, but can I help you?
No. No.
Buddy started back up the steps.
Wait, Bigger said.
Buddy came back and stood facing him, his eyes eager, shining. Bigger looked at him, his body as taut as that of an animal about to leap. But his brother would not betray him. He could trust Buddy. He caught Buddy's arm again and squeezed it until Buddy flinched with pain.
Don't you tell nobody, here?
No, no, I won't.
Go on back now. Buddy ran up the steps, out of sight. Bigger stood brooding in the shadows of the stairway. He thrust the feeling from him, not with shame, but with impatience. He had felt toward Buddy for an instant, as he had felt toward Mary when she lay upon the bed, with the white blur moving toward him in the hazy blue light of the room. But he won't tell, he thought. He went down the steps and into the street. The air was cold and the snow had stopped. Overhead the sky was clearing a little. As he neared the corner drugstore, which stayed open all night, he wondered if any of the gang was around. Maybe Jack or G.H. was hanging out and had not gone home as they sometimes did. Though he felt he was cut off from them forever, he had a strange hankering for their presence. He wanted to know how he would feel if he saw them again. Like a man reborn, he wanted to test and taste each thing now to see how it went. Like a man risen up well from a long illness, he felt deep and wayward whims. He peered through the frosted glass. Yes, G.H. was there. He opened the door and went in. G.H. sat at the fountain, talking to the soda jerk. Bigger sat next to him. They did not speak. Bigger bought two packages of cigarettes and shoved one of them to G.H., who looked at him in surprise.
This for me?
G.H. asked. Bigger waved his palm and pulled down the corners of his lips.
Sure.
G.H. opened the pack.
Jesus, I sure needed one. Say, you working now?
Yeah.
How you like it?
Swell.
Jack was telling me you saw the gal in the movie you supposed to drive around. Did you?
Sure.
How is she?
Oh, we like that, Bigger said, crossing his fingers. He was trembling with excitement, sweat on his forehead. He was excited, and something was impelling him to become more excited. It was like a thirst springing from his blood. The door opened, and Jack came in.
Say, how is it, Bigger?
Bigger wagged his head.
Honky-dory, he said.
Here, give me another pack of cigarettes, he told the clerk. This is for you, Jack.
Jesus, you and Clover, sure enough, Jack said, glimpsing the thick roll of bills.
Where's Gus? Bigger asked.
He'll be along in a minute. We've been hanging out at Claire's all night.
The door opened again. Bigger turned and saw Gus step inside. Gus paused.
Now, y'all don't fight, Jack said.
Bigger bought another pack of cigarettes and tossed it toward Gus. Gus caught it and stood, bewildered.
Aw, come on, Gus, forget it, Bigger said.
Gus came forward slowly. He opened the package and lit one.
Bigger, you sure is crazy, Gus said with a shy smile.
Bigger knew that Gus was glad that the fight was over. Bigger was not afraid of them now. He sat with his feet propped upon his suitcase, looking from one to the other with a quiet smile.
Let me have a dollar, Jack said.
Bigger peeled off a dollar bill for each of them.
Don't say I never give you nothing, he said laughing.
Bigger, you sure is one more crazy nigger, Gus said again, laughing with joy. But he had to go. He could not stay here talking with them. He ordered 3 bottles of beer and picked up his suitcase.
Ain't you gonna drink one too? G.H. asked.
Nah, I got to go.
We'll be seeing you.
So long. He waved at them and swung through the door. He walked over the snow, feeling giddy and elated. His mouth was open and his eyes shone. It was the first time he had ever been in their presence without feeling fearful. He was following a strange path into a strange land, and his nerves were hungry to see where it led. He lugged his suitcase to the end of the block and stood waiting for a streetcar. He slipped his fingers into his vest pocket and felt the crisp roll of bills. Instead of going to Dalton's, he could take a streetcar to a railway station and leave town. But what would happen if he left? If he ran away now, it would be thought at once that he knew something about Mary as soon as she was missed. No. It would be far better to stick it out and see what happened. It might be a long time before anyone would think that Mary was killed, and a still longer time before anyone would think that he had done it. And when Mary was missed, would they not think of the Reds first? The streetcar rumbled up, and he got on and rode to 47th Street, where he transferred to an eastbound car. He looked anxiously at the dim reflection of his black face in the sweaty window pane. Would any of the white faces all about him think that he had killed a rich white girl? No. They might think he would steal a dime, rape a woman, get drunk, or cut somebody. But to kill a millionaire's daughter and burn her body? He smiled a little, feeling a tingling sensation enveloping all his body. He saw it all very sharply and simply. Act like other people thought you ought to act, yet do what you wanted. In a certain sense, he had been doing just that in a loud and rough manner all his life. But it was only last night, when he had smothered Mary in her room while her blind mother had stood with outstretched arms, that he had seen how clearly it could be done. Although he was trembling a little, he was not really afraid. He was eager, tremendously excited. I can take care of them, he thought, thinking of Mr. and Mrs. Dalton. There was only one thing that worried him. He had to get that lingering image of Mary's bloody head lying on those newspapers from before his eyes. If that were done, then he would be all right. Gee, what a fool she was, he thought, remembering how Mary had acted carrying on that way. Hell, she made me do it. I couldn't help it. She should have known better. She should have left me alone, goddammit. He did not feel sorry for Mary. She was not real to him, not a human being. He had not known her long or well enough for that. He felt that his murder of her was more than amply justified by the fear and shame she had made him feel. It seemed that her actions had evoked fear and shame in him. But when he thought hard about it, it seemed impossible that they could have. He really did not know just where that fear and shame had come from. It had just been there. That was all. Each time he had come in contact with her, it had risen hot and hard. It was not Mary he was reacting to when he felt that fear and shame. Mary had served to set off his emotions, emotions conditioned by many Marys. And now that he had killed Mary, he felt a lessening of tension in his muscles. He had shed an invisible burden he had long carried. As the car lurched over the snow, he lifted his eyes and saw black people upon the snow-covered sidewalks. Those people had feelings of fear and shame like his. Many a time he had stood on street corners with them and talked of white people as long, sleek cars zoomed past. To Bigger and his kind, white people were not really people. They were a sort of great natural force, like a stormy sky looming overhead, or like a deep, swirling river stretching suddenly at one's feet in the dark. As long as he and his black folks did not go beyond certain limits, there was no need to fear that white force. But whether they feared it or not, each and every day of their lives they lived with it. Even when words did not sound its name, they acknowledged its reality. As long as they lived here in this prescribed corner of the city, they paid mute tribute to it. There were rare moments when a feeling and longing for solidarity with other black people would take hold of him. He would dream of making a stand against that white force, but that dream would fade when he looked at the other black people near him. Even though black like them, he felt there was too much difference between him and them to allow for a common binding and a common life. Only when threatened with death could that happen. Only in fear and shame, with their backs against a wall, could that happen. But never could they sink their differences in hope. As he rode, looking at the black people on the sidewalks, he felt that one way to end fear and shame was to make all those black people act together, rule them, tell them what to do, and make them do it. Dimly, he felt that there should be one direction in which he and all other black people could go wholeheartedly, that there should be a way in which gnawing hunger and restless aspiration could be fused, that there should be a manner of acting that caught the mind and body in certainty and faith. But he felt that such would never happen to him and his black people, and he hated them, and wanted to wave his hand and blot them out. Yet he still hoped, vaguely. Of late, he had liked to hear tell of men who could rule others, for in actions such as these he felt there was a way to escape from this tight morass of fear and shame that sapped at the base of his life. He liked to hear of how Japan was conquering China, of how Hitler was running the Jews to the ground, of how Mussolini was invading Spain. He was not concerned with whether these acts were right or wrong. They simply appealed to him as possible avenues of escape. He felt that someday there would be a black man who would whip the black people into a tight band, and together they would act and end fear and shame. He never thought of this in precise mental images. He felt it. He would feel it for a while, and then forget. But hope was always waiting somewhere deep down in him. It was fear that had made him fight Gus in the pool room. If he had felt certain of himself and of Gus, he would not have fought. But he knew Gus, as he knew himself, and he knew that one of them might fail through fear at the decisive moment. How could he think of going to rob Blum's that way? He distrusted and feared Gus and he knew that Gus distrusted and feared him. And the moment he tried to band himself and Gus together to do something, he would hate Gus and himself. Ultimately, though, his hate and hope turned outward from himself and Gus. His hope toward a vague benevolent something that would help and lead him, and his hate toward the whites. For he felt that they ruled him, even when they were far away and not thinking of him, ruled him by conditioning him in his relations to his own people. The streetcar crawled through the snow. Drexel Boulevard was the next stop. He lifted the suitcase and stood at the door. In a few minutes, he would know if Mary had burned. The car stopped. He swung off and walked through snow as deep as his ankles, heading for Dalton's. When he got to the driveway, he saw that the car was standing just as he had left it, but all covered with a soft coat of snow. The house loomed white and silent. He unlatched the gate and went past the car, seeing before his eyes an image of Mary, her bloody neck just inside the furnace, and her head with its curly black hair lying upon the soggy newspapers. He paused. He could turn round now and go back. He could get into the car and be miles from here before anybody knew it. But why run away, unless there was a good reason? He had some money to make a run for it when the time came, and he had his gun. His fingers trembled so that he had difficulty in unlocking the door, but they were not trembling from fear. It was a kind of eagerness he felt, a confidence, a fullness, a freedom. His whole life was caught up in a supreme and meaningful act. He pushed the door in, then was stone still, sucking his breath in softly. In the red glare of the furnace stood a shadowy figure. Is that Mrs. Dalton? But it was taller and stouter than Mrs. Dalton. Oh, it was Peggy. She stood with her back to him, a little bent. She seemed to be peering hard into the furnace. She didn't hear me come in, he thought. Maybe I ought to go. But before he could move, Peggy turned round.
Oh, good morning, Bigger.
He did not answer.
I'm glad you came. I was just about to put more coal into the fire.
I'll fix it, ma'am. He came forward, straining his eyes to see if any traces of Mary were in the furnace. When he reached Peggy's side, he saw that she was staring through the cracks of the door at the red bed of livid coals.
The fire was very hot last night, Peggy said. But this morning it got low.
I'll fix it, Bigger said, standing and not daring to open the door of the furnace while she stood there beside him in the red darkness. He heard the dull roar of the draft going upwards and wondered if she suspected anything. He knew that he should have turned on the light, but what if he did, and the light revealed parts of Mary in the furnace? I'll fix it, ma'am, he said again. Quickly, he wondered if he would have to kill her to keep her from telling if she turned on the light and saw something that made her think that Mary was dead. Without turning his head, he saw an iron shovel resting in a nearby corner. His hands clenched. Peggy moved from his side toward a light that swung from the ceiling at the far end of the room near the stairs.
I'll give you some light, she said.
He moved silently and quickly toward the shovel and waited to see what would happen. The light came on, blindingly bright. He blinked. Peggy stood near the steps, holding her right hand tightly over her breast. She had on a kimono and was trying to hold it closely about her. Bigger understood at once. She was not even thinking of the furnace. She was just a little ashamed at having been seen in the basement in her kimono.
Has Miss Dalton come down yet?
She asked over her shoulder as she went up the steps.
No'm, I haven't seen her.
You just come?
Yes'm.
She stopped and looked back at him.
But the car is in the driveway.
Yes'm.
He said simply, not volunteering any information.
Then it stayed out all night.
I don't know, ma'am.
Didn't you put it in the garage?
No'm. Miss Dalton told me to leave it out.
Oh, then it did stay out all night. That's why it's covered with snow.
I reckon so, ma'am.
Peggy shook her head and sighed. Well, I suppose she'll be ready for you to take her to the station in a few minutes.
Yes'm.
I see you brought the trunk down.
Yes'm. She told me to bring it down last night.
Don't forget it, she said, going through the kitchen door. For a long time after she had gone, he did not move from his tracks. Then slowly he looked round the basement, turning his head like an animal with eyes and ears alert, searching to see if anything was amiss. The room was exactly as he had left it last night. He walked about, looking closer. All at once he stopped, his eyes widening. Directly in front of him he saw a small piece of blood-stained newspaper, lying in the livid reflection cast by the cracks in the door of the furnace. Had Peggy seen that? He ran to the light and turned it out, and ran back and looked at the piece of paper. He could barely see it. That meant that Peggy had not seen it. How about Mary? Had she burned? He turned the light back on and picked up the piece of paper. He glanced to the left and right to see if anyone was watching, then opened the furnace door and peered in, his eyes filled with the vision of Mary and her bloody throat. The inside of the furnace breathed and quivered in the grip of fiery coals, but there was no sign of the body, even though the body's image hovered before his eyes, between his eyes and the bed of coals burning hotly. Like the oblong mound of fresh clay of a newly made grave, the red coals revealed the bent outline of Mary's body. He had the feeling that if he simply touched that red oblong mound with his finger, it would cave in and Mary's body would come into full view, unburnt. The coals had the appearance of having burnt the body beneath, leaving the glowing embers formed into a shell of red hotness, with a hollowed space in the center, keeping still in the embrace of the quivering coals the huddled shape of Mary's body. He blinked his eyes, and became aware that he still held the piece of paper in his hand. He lifted it to the level of the door, and the draft sucked it from his fingers. He watched it fly into the red trembling heat, smoke, turn black, blaze, then vanish. He shut the door, and pulled the lever for more coal. The rattling of the tiny lumps against the tin sides of the chute came loudly to his ears as the oblong mound of red fire turned gradually black and blazed from the fan-wise spreading of coal whirling into the furnace. He shut off the lever and stood up. Things were all right so far. As long as no one poked round in that fire, things would be all right. He himself did not want to poke in it, for fear that some part of Mary was still there. If things could go on like this until afternoon, Mary would be burned enough to make him safe. He turned and looked at the trunk again. Oh, he must not forget. He had to put those communist pamphlets in his room right away. He ran back to the furnace, up the steps to his room, and placed the pamphlets smoothly and neatly in a corner of his dresser drawer. Yes, they would have to be stacked neatly. No one must think that he had read them. He went back to the basement, dragged the trunk to the door, lifted it to his back, carried it to the car, and fastened it to the running board. He looked at his watch. It was 8:20. Now he would have to wait for Mary to come out. He took his seat at the steering wheel and waited for 5 minutes. He would ring the bell for her. He looked at the steps leading up to the side door of the house, remembering how Mary had stumbled last night, and how he had held her up. Then, involuntarily, he started in fright as a full blast of intense sunshine fell from the sky, making the snow leap and glitter and sparkle about him in a world of magic whiteness without sound. It's getting late. He would have to go in and ask for Miss Dalton. If he stayed here too long, It would seem that he was not expecting her to come down. He got out of the car and walked up the steps to the side door. He looked through the glass. No one was in sight. He tried to open the door and found it locked. He pushed the bell, hearing the gong sound softly within. He waited a moment, then saw Peggy hurrying down the hall. She opened the door.
Hasn't she come out yet?
No, and it's getting late.
Wait, I'll call her.
Peggy, still dressed in the kimono, ran up the stairs. The same stairs up which he had half-dragged Mary, and the same stairs down which he had stumbled with the trunk last night. Then he saw Peggy coming back down the stairs, much slower than she had gone up. She came to the door.
She ain't here. Maybe she's gone. What did she tell you?
She said to drive her to the station and to take her trunk, ma'am.
Well, she ain't in her room, and she ain't in Mrs. Dalton's room. And Mr. Dalton's asleep. Did she tell you she was going this morning?
That's what she told me last night, ma'am.
She told you to bring the trunk down last night?
Yes'm.
Peggy thought a moment, looking past him at the snow-covered car.
Well, you better take the trunk on. Maybe she didn't stay here last night.
Yes'm.
He turned and started down the steps.
Bigger?
Yes'm.
You say she told you to leave the car out all night?
Yes'm.
Did she say she was going to use it again?
No'm. You see, Bigger said, feeling his way. He was in it.
Who?
The gentleman.
Oh, yes. Take the trunk on. I suppose Mary was up to some of her pranks.
He got into the car and pulled it down the driveway to the street, then headed northward over the snow. He wanted to look back and see if Peggy was watching him, but dared not. That would make her think that he thought that something was wrong, and he did not want to give that impression now. Well, at least he had one person thinking it as he wanted it thought. He reached the LaSalle Street station, pulled the car to a platform, backed into a narrow space between other cars, hoisted the trunk up, and waited for a man to give him a ticket for the trunk. He wondered what would happen if no one called for it. Maybe they would notify Mr. Dalton. Well, he would wait and see. He had done his part. Miss Dalton had asked him to take the trunk to the station, and he had done it. He drove as hurriedly back to the Daltons as the snow-covered streets would allow him. He wanted to be back on the spot to see what would happen, to be there with his fingers on the pulse of time. He reached the driveway and nosed the car into the garage, locked it, and then stood wondering if he ought to go to his room or to the kitchen. It would be better to go straight to the kitchen, as though nothing had happened. He had not as yet eaten his breakfast, as far as Peggy was concerned, and his coming into the kitchen would be thought natural. He went through the basement, pausing to look at the roaring furnace, and then went to the kitchen door and stepped in softly. Peggy stood at the gas stove with her back to him. She turned and gave him a brief glance.
You make it all right?
Yes'm.
You see her down there?
No'm.
Hungry?
A little, ma'am.
A little?
Peggy laughed. You'll get used to how this house is run on Sundays. Nobody gets up early, and when they do, they're almost famished.
I'm all right, ma'am.
That was the only kick Green had while he was working here,
Peggy said.
He swore we starved him on Sundays.
Bigger forced a smile and looked down at the black and white linoleum on the floor. What would she think if she knew? He felt very kindly toward Peggy just then. He felt he had something of value which she could never take from him, even if she despised him. He heard a phone ring in the hallway. Peggy straightened and looked at him as she wiped her hands on her apron.
"Who on earth's calling here this early on a Sunday morning?" she mumbled.
She went out, and he sat, waiting. Maybe that was Jan asking about Mary. He remembered that Mary had promised to call him. He wondered how long it took to go to Detroit. 5 or 6 hours? It was not far. Mary's train had already gone. About 4 o'clock she would be due in Detroit. Maybe someone had planned to meet her. If she was not on the train, would they call or wire about it? Peggy came back, went to the stove, and continued cooking.
"Things will be ready in a minute," she said.
"Yes'm."
Then she turned to him.
"Who was the gentleman with Miss Dalton last night?"
"I don't know, ma'am. I think she called him Jan or something like that."
"Jan? He just called," Peggy said.
She tossed her head and her lips tightened.
"He's a no-good one, if there ever was one. One of them anarchists who's agin the government."
Bigger listened and said nothing.
"What on earth a good girl like Mary wants to hang around with that crazy bunch for, God only knows. Nothing good'll come of it, just you mark my word. If it wasn't for that Mary and her wild ways, this household would run like a clock. It's such a pity, too. Her mother's the very soul of goodness. And there never was a finer man than Mr. Dalton. But later on, Mary'll settle down. They all do. They think they're missing something unless they kick up their heels when they're young and foolish."
She brought a bowl of hot oatmeal and milk to him, and he began to eat. He had difficulty in swallowing, for he had no appetite. But he forced the food down. Peggy talked on, and he wondered what he should say to her. He found that he could say nothing. Maybe she was not expecting him to say anything. Maybe she was talking to him because she had no one else to talk to, like his mother did sometimes. Yes, he would see about the fire again when he got to the basement. He would fill that furnace as full of coal as it would get and make sure that Mary burned in a hurry. The hot cereal was making him sleepy, and he suppressed a yawn.
"What all I got to do today, ma'am?"
"Just wait on call. Sunday's a dull day. Maybe Mr. or Mrs. Dalton'll go out."
"Yes'm."
He finished the oatmeal.
"You want me to do anything now?"
"No. But you're not through eating. You want some ham and eggs?"
"No'm, I got plenty."
"Well, it's right here for you. Don't be afraid to ask for it."
"I reckon I'll see about the fire now."
"All right, Bigger. Just you listen for the bell about 2 o'clock. Till then, I don't think there'll be anything."
This ends Disc 4. Native Son, Disc 5.
He went to the basement. The fire was blazing. The embers glowed red and the draft droned upward. It did not need any coal. Again he looked round the basement, into every nook and corner, to see if he had left any trace of what had happened last night. There was none. He went to his room and lay on the bed. Well, here he was now. What would happen? The room was quiet. No, he heard something. He cocked his head, listening. He caught faint sounds of pots and pans rattling in the kitchen below. He got up and walked to the far end of the room. The sounds came louder. He heard the soft but firm tread of Peggy as she walked across the kitchen floor. "She's right under me," he thought. He stood still, listening. He heard Mrs. Dalton's voice, then Peggy's. He stooped and put his ear to the floor. Were they talking about Mary? He could not make out what they were saying. He stood up and looked round. A foot from him was the door of the clothes closet. He opened it. The voices came clearly. He went into the closet, and the plank squeaked. He stopped. Had they heard him? Would they think he was snooping? Oh, he had an idea. He got his suitcase and opened it, and took out an armful of clothes. If anyone came to the room, it would seem that he was putting his clothes away. He went into the closet and listened.
You mean the car stayed out all night in the driveway?
Yes. He said she told him to leave it there.
What time was that?
I don't know, Mrs. Dalton. I didn't ask him.
I don't understand this at all.
Oh, she's all right. I don't think you need worry.
But she didn't even leave a note, Peggy. That's not like Mary.
Even when she ran away to New York that time, she at least left a note.
Maybe she hasn't gone. Maybe something came up and she stayed out all night, Mrs. Dalton.
But why would she leave the car out?
I don't know.
And he said a man was with her?
It was Jan, I think, Mrs. Dalton.
Jan?
Yes, the one who was with her in Florida.
She just won't leave those awful people alone.
He called here this morning asking for her.
Called here?
Yes.
And what did he say?
He seemed sort of peeved when I told him she was gone.
What can that poor child be up to?
She told me she was not seeing him anymore. Maybe she had him to call, Mrs. Dalton.
What do you mean?
Well, ma'am, I was kind of thinking that maybe she's with him again, like that time she was in Florida. And maybe she had him to call to see if we knew she was gone.
Oh, Peggy.
Oh, I'm sorry, ma'am. Maybe she stayed with some friends of hers.
But she was in her room at 2 o'clock this morning, Peggy. Whose house would she go to at that hour?
Mrs. Dalton, I noticed something when I went to her room this morning.
What?
Well, ma'am, it looks like her bed wasn't slept in at all. The cover wasn't even pulled back. Looks like somebody had just stretched out a while and then got up.
Oh.
Bigger listened intently, but there was silence. They knew that something was wrong now. He heard Mrs. Dalton's voice again, quavering with doubt and fear.
Then she didn't sleep here last night.
Looks like she didn't.
Did that boy say Jan was in the car?
Yes. I thought something was strange about the car being left out in the snow all night, and so I asked him. He said she told him to leave the car there, and he said Jan was in it.
Listen, Peggy.
Yes, Mrs. Dalton.
Mary was drunk last night.
I hope nothing's happened to her.
Oh, what a pity. I went to her room just after she came in. She was too drunk to talk. She was drunk, I tell you. I never thought she'd come home in that condition.
She'll be all right, Mrs. Dalton. I know she will. There was another long silence. Bigger wondered if Mrs. Dalton was on her way to his room. He went back to the bed and lay down, listening. There were no sounds. He lay a long time, hearing nothing. Then he heard footsteps in the kitchen again. He hurried into the closet.
Peggy.
Yes, Mrs. Dalton.
Listen, I just felt around in Mary's room. Something's wrong. She didn't finish packing her trunk. At least half of her things are still there. She said she was planning to go to some dances in Detroit, and she didn't take the new things she bought.
Maybe she didn't go to Detroit.
But where is she?
Bigger stopped listening, feeling fear for the first time. He had not thought that the trunk was not fully packed. How could he explain that she had told him to take a half-packed trunk to the station? Oh, shucks. The girl was drunk. That was it. Mary was so drunk that she didn't know what she was doing. He would say that she had told him to take it, and he had just taken it. That's all. If someone asked him why he had taken a half-packed trunk to the station, he would tell them that that was no different from all the other foolish things that Mary had told him to do that night. Had not people seen him eating with her and Jan in Ernie's kitchen shack? He would say that both of them were drunk, and that he had done what they told him, because it was his job. He listened again to the voices.
"And after a while, send that boy to me. I want to talk to him."
"Yes, Mrs. Dalton."
Again, he lay on the bed. He would have to go over his story and make it foolproof. Maybe he had done wrong in taking that trunk. Maybe it would have been better to have carried Mary down in his arms and burnt her. But he had put her in the trunk because of the fear of someone seeing her in his arms. That was the only way he could have gotten her down out of the room. Oh, hell. What had happened, and he would stick to his story. He went over the story again, fastening every detail firmly in his mind. He would say that she had been drunk, sloppy drunk. He lay on the soft bed in the warm room, listening to the steam hiss in the radiator, and thinking drowsily and lazily of how drunk she had been, and of how he had lugged her up the steps, and of how he had pushed the pillow over her face, and of how he had put her in the trunk, and of how he had struggled with the trunk on the dark stairs, and of how his fingers had burned while he had stumbled down the stairs with the heavy trunk going bump, bump, bump so loud that surely all the world must have heard it. He jumped awake, hearing a knock at the door. His heart raced. He sat up and stared sleepily around the room. Had someone knocked? He looked at his watch. It was 3 o'clock.
Gee.
He must have slept through the bell that was to ring at 2. The knock came again.
"Okay," he mumbled.
"This is Mrs. Dalton."
"Yes'm, just a minute."
He reached the door in 2 long steps, then stood a moment trying to collect himself. He blinked his eyes and wet his lips. He opened the door and saw Mrs. Dalton smiling before him, dressed in white, her pale face held as it had been when she was standing in the darkness while he had smothered Mary on the bed.
"Yes, ma'am," he stammered. I was asleep."
"You didn't get much sleep last night, did you?"
"No'm," he drawled, afraid of what she might mean.
"Peggy rang for you 3 times. You didn't answer."
"I'm sorry, ma'am."
"That's all right. I wanted to ask you about last night." "Oh, you took the trunk to the station, didn't you?" she asked.
"Yes'm, this morning," he said,
detecting hesitancy and confusion in her voice.
"I see," said Mrs. Dalton.
She stood with her face tilted upward in the semi-darkness of the hallway. He had his hand on the doorknob, waiting, his muscles taut. He had to be careful with his answers now. And yet he knew he had a certain protection. He knew that a certain element of shame would keep Mrs. Dalton from asking him too much and letting him know that she was worried. He was a boy, and she was an old woman. He was the hired, and she was the hirer. And there was a certain distance to be kept between them.
"You left the car in the driveway last night, didn't you?"
"Yes'm. I was about to put it up," he said, indicating that his only concern was with keeping his job and doing his duties. "But she told me to leave it."
"And was someone with her?"
"Yes'm. A gentleman."
"That must have been pretty late, wasn't it?"
"Yes'm. A little before 2, ma'am."
"And you took the trunk down a little before 2?
Yes'm. She told me to.
She took you to her room?
He did not want her to think that he had been alone in the room with Mary. Quickly, he recast the story in his mind.
Yes'm. They went up.
Oh, he was with her.
Yes'm.
I see.
Anything wrong, ma'am?
Oh, no, No. There's nothing wrong.
She stood in the doorway, and he looked at her light gray blind eyes. Eyes almost as white as her face and hair and dress. He knew that she was really worried, and wanted to ask him more questions. But he knew that she would not want to hear him tell of how drunk her daughter had been. After all, he was black, and she was white. He was poor, and she was rich. She would be ashamed to let him think that something was so wrong in her family that she had to ask him, a black servant, about it. He felt confident.
Will there be anything right now, ma'am?
No. In fact, you may take the rest of the day off, if you like. Mr. Dalton is not feeling well, and we're not going out.
Thank you, ma'am.
She turned away, and he shut the door. He stood listening to the soft whisper of her shoes die away down the hall, then on the stairs. He pictured her groping her way, her hands touching the walls. She must know this house like a book, he thought. He trembled with excitement. She was white and he was black. She was rich and he was poor. She was old and he was young. She was the boss and he was the worker. He was safe. Yes. When he heard the kitchen door open and shut, he went to the closet and listened again, but there were no sounds. Well, he would go out. To go out now would be the answer to the feeling of strain that had come over him while talking to Mrs. Dalton. He would go and see Bessie. That was it. He got his cap and coat and went to the basement. The suction of air through the furnace moaned, and the fire was white hot. There was enough coal to last until he came back. He went to 47th Street and stood on the corner to wait for a car.
Yes, Bessie was the one he wanted to see now.
Funny. He had not thought of her much during the last day and night. Too many exciting things had been happening. He had had no need to think of her, but now he had to forget and relax, and he wanted to see her. She was always home on Sunday afternoons. He wanted to see her very badly. He felt that he would be stronger to go through tomorrow if he saw her. The streetcar came, and he got on, thinking of how things had gone that day. No, he did not think they would suspect him of anything. He was black. Again, he felt the roll of crisp bills in his pocket. If things went wrong, he could always run away. He wondered how much money was in the roll. He had not even counted it. He would see when he got to Bessie's. No, he need not be afraid. He felt the gun nestling close to his skin. That gun could always make folks stand away and think twice before bothering him. But of the whole business, there was one angle that bothered him. He should have gotten more money out of it. He should have planned it. He had acted too hastily and accidentally. Next time, things would be much different. He would plan and arrange so that he would have money enough to keep him a long time. He looked out of the car window and then round at the white faces near him. He wanted suddenly to stand up and shout, telling them that he had killed a rich white girl, a girl whose family was known to all of them. Yes, if he did that, a look of startled horror would come over their faces. But no, he would not do that, even though the satisfaction would be keen. He was so greatly outnumbered that he would be arrested, tried, and executed. He wanted the keen thrill of startling them, but felt that the cost was too great. He wished that he had the power to say what he had done without fear of being arrested. He wished that he could be an idea in their minds, that his black face and the image of his smothering Mary and cutting off her head and burning her could hover before their eyes as a terrible picture of reality which they could see and feel and yet not destroy. He was not satisfied with the way things stood now. He was a man who had come in sight of a goal, then had won it, and in winning it had seen just within his grasp another goal, higher, greater. He had learned to shout and had shouted, and no ear had heard him. He had just learned to walk and was walking, but could not see the ground beneath his feet. He had long been yearning for weapons to hold in his hands and suddenly found that his hands held weapons that were invisible. The car stopped a block from Bessie's home, and he got off. When he reached the building in which she lived, he looked up to the second floor and saw light burning in the window. The street lamps came on suddenly, lighting up the snow-covered sidewalks with a yellow sheen. It had gotten dark early. The lamps were round, hazy balls of light, frozen into motionlessness, anchored in space and kept from blowing away in the icy wind by black steel posts. He went in and rang the bell, and in answer to a buzzer, mounted the stairs and found Bessie smiling at him in her door.
"Hello, stranger."
"Hi, Bessie."
He stood face to face with her, then reached for her hands. She shied away.
"What's the matter?"
"You know what's the matter."
"No, I don't."
"What you reaching for me for?"
"I want to kiss you, honey."
"You don't want to kiss me."
"Right.
I ought to be asking you that."
"What's the matter?"
"I saw you with your white friends last night."
"Oh, they wasn't my friends."
"Who was they?"
"I work for them."
"And you eat with them."
"Oh, Bessie."
"You didn't even speak to me."
"I did."
"You just growled and waved your hand."
"Oh, baby, I was working then. You understand."
"I thought maybe you were ashamed of me, sitting there with that white gal all dressed in silk and satin."
"Oh, hell, Bessie, come on. Don't act that way."
"You really want to kiss me?"
"Sure. What you think I came here for?"
"How come you so long seeing me then?"
"I told you I've been working, honey. You saw me last night. Come on, don't act this way."
"I don't know,"
she said, shaking her head. He knew that she was trying to see how badly he wanted her, trying to see how much power she still had over him. He grabbed her arm and pulled her to him, kissing her long and hard, feeling as he did so that she was not responding. When he took his lips away, he looked at her with eyes full of reproach, and at the same time he felt his teeth clamping and his lips tingling slightly with rising passion.
"Let's go in," he said.
"If you want to."
"Sure I want to."
"You stayed away so long."
"Oh, don't be that way." They went in. "How come you acting so cold at night?" he asked.
"You could have dropped me a postcard," she said.
"Oh, I just forgot it."
"Or you could have phoned."
"Honey, I was busy."
"Looking at that old white gal, I reckon."
"Oh, hell."
"You don't love me no more."
"The hell I don't."
"You could have come by just for 5 minutes."
"Baby, I was busy."
When he kissed her this time, she responded a little. To let her know that he wanted her, he allowed her to draw his tongue into her mouth.
"I'm tired tonight," she sighed.
"Who you been seeing?"
"Nobody."
"What you doing tired?"
"If you want to talk that way, you can leave right now.
I didn't ask you who you been seeing to make you stay away this long, did I?
You all on edge tonight.
You could have just said, hello, doll.
Really, honey, I was busy.
You was sitting there at that table with them white folks like you was a lawyer or something. You wouldn't even look at me when I spoke to you.
Oh, forget it. Let's talk about something else.
He attempted to kiss her again, and she shied away.
Come on, honey.
Who you been with?
Nobody. I swear I've been working. And I've been thinking hard about you. I've been missing you. Listen, I got a room all my own where I'm working. Some nights you can stay there with me, see? Gee, I've been missing you awful, honey. Soon as I got time, I came right over.
He stood looking at her in the dim light of the room. She was teasing him, and he liked it. At least it took him away from that terrible image of Mary's head lying on the bloody newspaper. He wanted to kiss her again, but deep down, he did not really mind her standing off from him. It made him hunger more keenly for her. She was looking at him wistfully, half leaning against a wall, her hands on her hips. Then suddenly, he knew how to draw her out, to drive from her mind all thought of her teasing him. He reached into his pocket and drew forth the roll of bills. Smiling, he held it in his palm and spoke as though to himself.
Well, I reckon somebody else might like this if you don't.
She came a step forward.
Bigger? Gee, where you get all that money from?
Wouldn't you like to know?
How much is it?
What do you care?
She came to his side.
How much is it, really?
What do you want to know for?
Let me see it. I'll give it back to you.
I'll let you see it. But it'll have to stay in my hands, see?
He watched the expression of coyness on her face change to one of amazement as she counted the bills.
Lord, bigger! Where you get this money from?
Wouldn't you like to know, he said, slipping his arm about her waist.
Is it yours?
What in hell you reckon I'm doing with it?
Tell me where you get it from, honey.
You going to be sweet to me?
He felt her body growing gradually less stiff, but her eyes were